Hello and welcome to the EIQ podcast.
Hello, and welcome.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I am well. I'm not great, only because I just have a slight illness. Nothing bad, just like the little bit of I'm not 100%. And I think because I normally feel really good when I'm absolutely fine, but I'm just not 100%. Yeah.
Feeling. Oh, that's very upsetting, although not really that upsetting, just a
Not that
bit.
upsetting, but and I was thinking this before I came on. I was like, oh God, I just keep needing to like eat a little bit of something, like just like some fruit or so, always have something. And I was like, I can't really say that to Amelia because it's literally been her whole pregnancy. I'm like, oh yeah, I don't know if you could relate to this, but like for one day, I've just been like a little bit like picky with stuff.
The thing is too, like when you're picky, you'll be like, oh, I'm picky for some fruit or something refreshing. And I'm like, oh, I'm picky for some pastries and Ben and Jerry's.
Yeah,
That's
whenever I'm ill, I really just want like a constant influx of like fruit, anything that's like fresh and crunchy.
Whereas like I have definitive cravings for pastries and things. And I thought, okay, I'll just not have them for a while because maybe I'm quote unquote craving them. You know, when you begin to have things more, you want them more. That's not the case. I just want them more. So such is life for now. That's fine.
Chloe just messaged me saying, she was like, I'm having the most obscene craving for pizza. She's like, I can't stop thinking about it. It's been over 2 hours. I was like, just have it. Oh, funny.
What a mood. Okay, do you got anything that you want to talk about, or should we crack on with the questions?
Oh, I watched a really good webinar. So one of my clients is a GP and specializes in women's health and menopause, and she sent me like her CPD conference thing. I was like, oh, great. So that was really interesting. A lot of it was to do with breast cancer and people who have been through breast cancer and then can't take HRT. So yeah, it was really, really good. And then there was quite a lot as well on misinformation by doctors on social media, like, but directly about doctors on social media. And I was like, oh, interesting. And she's like, because I guess from the other perspective, it's quite interesting. If you think about it from the GP's perspective, they're now having this issue where they get a lot of clients, or not clients, patients, that's the right word, coming to them saying, well, I've heard I should, why won't you give me this? I've heard I should be having this. I saw this on Instagram. Davina McCall told me that HRT will change your life. And, like she got her whole life back and stuff. And on the one side, it's like, it's so good that we're talking about this more. But on the other side, it's like 50% of women that go on HRT don't have that big an improvement in symptoms. Like it's not for a lot of people, it's not this like magic quick fix of like it will just take away all your menopausal symptoms. And then you've got this group of people who have already been through a hell of a lot with breast cancer, who can't take HRT, who feel like they're massively missing out on something because everyone's like, ah, people giving you HRT, like as if it's like this miracle. And they've got really bad FOMO and they don't feel heard. And then yeah, it's just. Yeah, it was just interesting, like looking at it from that perspective and like how you would speak to a patient about that maybe not being the right choice for them, or even, they are on HRT and they're like, why don't I just feel amazing again? And it's like, well, actually, a lot of the symptoms of menopause might not be due to the drop in estrogen. It might be other things that are going on. And that an HRT is not going to help that.
Interesting. I think it raises like a wider point for sure around like this narrative around women's health at the moment, which is like no one's ever listened to us. And so now everything has to be listened to. And I think everything should be listened to. And I think, like you said, the conversations are so important. But I was having a couple of conversations off the back of a post the other week, and it was like, people telling me that they've got, medical problems that their doctor has said this is the best thing for them, and then they're like, but I just don't think it is because I've seen people say I shouldn't be on the pill or I shouldn't be doing these things. And I've always just said, okay, well, if you feel that way, self-advocate, go back and speak to them about it. But it must be so frustrating, because ultimately, like, the doctors know that the research might not be robust in certain things around the availability of these things for women's health. And so it must be frustrating for them to kind of have to have these conversations over and over again when they're, whether it be Davina McCall or someone else, like social media narratives at the moment are just like, you can't trust doctors. Doctors will just put you on the pill and they will never listen to you and don't even like that must be really hard to be in that position. But maybe it's a mandatory, it's like a pendulum swing to the other way. And then it's like eventually, hopefully, it sits somewhere in the middle.
I think it is hard as well because, like, as a GP, obviously a lot of them are, and I know it's not all about money, but right, a lot of them are paid very well, but not half as much as the influencer that's peddling some shitty menopause supplement, right? And you kind of have to be like, they're like, oh, but big pharma, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no. I want the best for you as my patient. Same as what you would say to your clients, and this might be in a slightly different realm, but like, oh, should I take this supplement that so and so influencer said, or should I go on this crash diet or whatever? It's like, as my client, I want the absolute best for you. I have no bias here. I'm not selling you supplements. I'm not endorsed by this. I'm not endorsed by that. And it's like, you kind of need to get, I guess, doctors need to do the same thing of, I don't have an agenda here. I want the best for you. It genuinely doesn't cost me anything to prescribe you HRT if I thought that was the best thing for you. But if it's not, I'm not going to do that because I've made an oath that I will do no harm and I will do the best for my patient. And I think sometimes it's the reminder of that. And it's right, it's making people feel heard, which is hard in a 10-minute consultation. But then it's also being like, I'm on your team. Like I want the best for you. There's no like agenda here. Whereas the and sometimes it's hard to see until you point it out. Like a lot of other people do have an agenda behind what they're saying, or a personal bias, which might not, I mean, and like credit to Davina McCall for talking about this so much and like being a huge advocate for menopausal women, but it like her own experience is being shown as like maybe what might potentially be the norm. Now, I don't even think she's purposely doing that, but as a byproduct of like social media, like that's the effect it's having. So it's like, well, this worked for me, and I think that's important to share, but then it's important to also share that might not work for everybody. Yeah, it is a hard balance, and yeah, it's, especially when people are struggling and they're desperate for anything, and what their doctor's saying at the moment probably isn't what they want to hear. Much like, when we have clients and we're like, you probably shouldn't take another supplement, or I get why people just want to take a supplement. If I could pay 30 quid a month to for some supplement and it would just like really help with my hunger or make me leaner or whatever, it's like that's way better than having to put any effort in. Like, yes, please. The point is, like, that's not how it works, right? And if it was, I'd be having all my clients taking it. Like, of course I would. Why not? I want the best for them. If it was going to work, I'd be like, yes, take it. Yeah.
Agree. Agree. Okay, Leanne's question. Hi both. I suppose this question is more related to Emma, as I know you have spoken quite a bit about time-restricted eating recently. I saw a headline about how its long-term effects and did a bit of search and I found this. So the, what she's posted is a link to Newsroom article, 8 hour time restricted eating linked to a 91% higher risk of cardiovascular death. So there's no question, but more just an observation of that. I don't know if you saw that.
I've not seen it, and I will find the link and have a look at it. I find that very hard to believe. I can't see what the mechanism behind that would be.
I think that's the
But
point.
also, I've not read it, so like I can't.
I saw, weirdly, I read this because I saw it on social media a couple of weeks ago and I was like, what on earth? So I weirdly, I can't remember who talked about it. So I looked it up at the time. It's not a study. So what it was like a poster presentation. So for reference, poster presentations are like if people do research and then they present it somewhere, they'll put all the research together and like share the results, but it's not been peer reviewed, which means it's not published in a journal yet. Does that matter? Maybe not. But the whenever you see any sort of health research and it's like 91% difference. Like, we've spoken about this quite a lot in terms of relative risk and absolute risk. An absolute risk is like, okay, you go from having a risk of 2 in 100 of cardiovascular death to 4 in 100. Like, or yeah, like that's an absolute risk. But a relative risk is like, oh, that's like a 200% increase. I don't know what that percentage is. I can't do the math, but it sounds much higher than it is. So always be mindful of that. But this piece of research, they looked at like over 20,000 people. But it wasn't an intervention. So they didn't do time restricted feeding for these people. They looked at like what people already did, and they used 2 24-hour recalls. So they asked people what they did for the last 24 hours, and they used that as an indication of their dietary patterns over the course of years. So they were like, okay, those 2 24-hour-a-day recalls that you've given us, from that, we're deducing that that's how you eat for a number of consecutive years, which is slightly obscene in itself. If you think how you ate this time last year or the year before or even last week, it's potentially very, very different. Maybe not if you're like fitness and you eat the same stuff every day, but on the whole, most people are like that. And like you said, there's no physical, like no mechanistic link that I'm with the same like that I could think about. And then if you look at people who tend to eat within like it, the idea was people who ate within an 8 hour window were more likely, 91% more likely to die of cardiovascular disease. But again, they looked at some confounders, but not others. So people who eat within that 8 hour window might have so many different other habits that potentially have contributed to those outcomes that they haven't controlled for. Ultimately, like, it's not a peer-reviewed study. There's a lot of potential flaws in it, and there is a lot of peer-reviewed research that actually shows that intermittent fasting can potentially be helpful and potentially have metabolic benefits, like that are meta-analyses that look at the research that we have. So I would take that until it's peer-reviewed and published, I would take that with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, and also they don't, I'm just like skimming it here, like they don't mention any mechanism, obviously, because it's not what they tested, it's just an observational study, but they've not looked at diet quality either. Now I don't know why that would be impacted by the length of time that you're eating, unless, and yeah, I don't know, because some people with quite poor dietary habits would, you know, maybe they're people who sleep in and then eat in a shorter time period, or like eat much later at night. And yeah, because I guess that's one of the things that's come out of the time restricted eating is less like the window of time does seem to have an impact, but also how much you're eating at certain parts of the day in relation to your circadian rhythm and when you wake up and when you're most active, which obviously hasn't been considered here.
Exactly.
Is, I mean, like the 91% increase is like obviously headline bam, but then you think, okay, well, as like a 49-year-old, which is the average age, like what's that, what does that actually look like in terms of relative risk versus absolute risk? But I mean,
Yeah.
almost 100% increase is like, even if yeah, that's still quite drastic.
Do you? This is exposing my maths. I don't care. I've never said I'm good at maths. Is a 1 in 100 risk going to a 2 in 100 risk? Is that 100% increase?
100%.
So it could be some. It's not going to be that, right? But just I suppose it's a nice example.
As like a, yeah, as an example, yeah. But normally it's like your risk is 0.005% or something. You know, remember the colon cancer stuff, and it was like your normal risk is 0.004%. It wasn't that. I've just made that more extreme, but it was 0.0 something. And then it like had doubled or something, and it was like, oh, all over the news. It's like, not to, you know, turn your nose up at any increase in risk of cancer, but it's not quite the headline that you think it is, you know. And as like okay, you're the average American adult at 49 years old, I don't actually think as much as, you know, the average person now is overweight and unhealthy, like I don't think your risk of a heart attack is particularly, or card, no, actually, this is the point. Cardiovascular death at 49 years old, your risk is pretty damn low anyway. So the increase in risk might be pretty small as well, even though it is 100% increase.
Okay. Lena's question: are there any studies to support peanuts being inflammatory? I've noticed that some anti-inflammatory protocols mention excluding them, but I've also read the opposite. I'm not sure if this is one of those myths or if there's some basis to it. Would love to hear your views. You'll never hear us say like one food is inflammatory or one food is anti-inflammatory. When we're looking at like anti-inflammatory foods, we're looking at foods that I think like high in polyphenols, antioxidants on the whole. But when you speak to someone who's like an evidence-based nutritionist person, dietitian, etc., they'll talk about dietary patterns because you just cannot, you no one's ever been on a peanut-only diet and then looked at the manifestations in their body, and controlled for, other confounders like exercise and stuff like that. It's obscene because no one's ever going to eat like that. So why would we ever do that? You can't just take it's a really reductionist thing to do, to be like, this food does this food does that on the whole. They're not, so I don't really have a specific answer in the sense of them being inflammatory. Would I include them if I was looking at an overall anti-inflammatory diet? Peanuts wouldn't be the first thing on my list to include, but they wouldn't be something I would exclude. If you look at something like Mediterranean style dietary pattern, we still include nuts in there, but it's often things like walnuts or almonds and stuff. But
Yeah, but babe, a peanut's a nut.
you're
They're
as you
actually a
right.
legume, aren't they?
Are they?
Yes.
Peanuts are legume.
Yeah. Oh, wait. And now I'm like, are they?
Flabbergasted.
Yeah, they are. How did you not know that? That's like a whole thing.
Clearly, I didn't. I didn't know. I have never learned that. That's
Legume of the
great.
month of Harvard Health. Yeah,
Oh
there you go.
my gosh, that's a great fact.
Even though nut is in its name, a peanut is actually a legume. Like soybeans, lentils, and other legumes, peanuts are edible seeds that grow in pods.
Wow. In which case, I would probably include them as part of an anti-inflammatory diet.
Yeah.
Just avoid it. I would honestly avoid anything that says you should or shouldn't, this one food does this one specific thing. No, I wouldn't say it. A peanut is an inflammatory food if I was had a gun to my head.
Oh, hold on. Is a peanut, this is from the peanutshellers.org/FAQs. Is a peanut a nut or a legume? Both. Botanically, peanuts are classified as legumes, like other legumes, blah, 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 blah. However, oh, this is more like for research and nutritional purposes. Peanuts, like walnuts and almonds, are considered a nut. In fact, they provide the best sorts of plant-based protein when considered to other nuts. Well, there you go.
Interesting.
I was
Interesting.
going to say, like, not that many people eat that much peanuts, but I think with peanut butter, a lot of people do eat a lot of peanuts.
Yeah. Okay. Anne's question. Hello, me again. Stress slash cortisol and weight gain or fat distribution. I understand the effects that stress has on a person and so their behaviours, which then makes fat loss more difficult. But what is the link, if any, between cortisol and fat distribution? Would someone who is chronically stressed and eating in a surplus be more likely to increase the body fat around their midsection because of cortisol? And if so, why? Why? I've not seen this anywhere, but everyone, like all the coaches I work with, are talking about, oh, I'm sick of seeing stress and cortisol, and it's clearly everywhere at the moment. I just must not have it on my
So
radar.
I don't get targeted with the ads or anything, but I've had loads of like my half my question boxes. So should I worry about cortisol?
So yeah, interesting. I don't get it. Oh, sad.
Yeah. I think there's a few points to make here. One being that most people are making quite a big assumption that just because you feel stressed, you have chronically high cortisol levels and that that's a problem. Most people haven't been tested for that. Now, there are some caveats to this, like is it Cushing disease?
Cushing.
Crushing.
Cush is not Cushing's.
Yeah. But aside from that, which would be a completely different medical issue, what these ads are mostly targeted at, or these supplements mostly targeted at, is just people who are like, oh, do you feel stressed? It kind of reminds me of adrenal fatigue. Like, do you ever feel a little bit tired or stressed? Oh, well, then you definitely have adrenal fatigue. It's like, no, and this is probably slightly unpopular, but there's an air of ADHD with that as well, of like, do you ever struggle to concentrate? ADHD. I'm like, I don't know. Like, a lot of these things are completely normal human emotions. And I did see like some meme recently, and it was like something along the lines of like how we're all like jumping to diagnose ourselves with mental health conditions for completely normal human, like, are you a little bit anxious? Well, you don't have anxiety. The likelihood is you just have normal emotions too. Stressful situations. Wow, that was a bit of a tangent, but back to cortisol. It's not going to stop you losing fat in a calorie deficit, is the crux of it. Is there a link between higher cortisol levels and increased visceral fat storage? Yes. Well, what was the other point I was going to make about cortisol? I think the other thing that I was looking at yesterday is that overweight, but very overweight and obese people do have chronically high levels of cortisol, but so do starving people. Like, it's a signal of like stress in the body, and actually starving people have far higher levels of cortisol than overweight people. And again, it's like I'm using that as a crude example of like it can't make you store calories that aren't there.
I agree. And the mechanisms, I think there's been multiple potential to do with things like, especially in women, there's some sort of reason, and I don't know the specifics, I don't actually know if the specifics are known around like its impact or its interaction on the HPA axis. Something we speak about in the women's health lecture is the stress and HPO axis, but specifically HPA axis. There's also like the way that cortisol can, like one of the things that cortisol does is like it mobilizes fat, like fat mobilization and then potentially relocation. And then if you think about like there are more receptors around like visceral areas potentially, and so fat may relocate viscerally. So there's that potential reason. Yeah. But the specific, it's not like we don't have this very specific clear pathway. There's other receptors that are potentially like differentially expressed in men. But we don't have like this, okay, cortisol does this, this causes fat cells to do this, fat then becomes relocated here because of this. Like that's not just
And
not
also,
clear.
anyone who does explain things like that, like whether it's cortisol or insulin or glucose, it's a complete oversimplification. Like, cortisol will also be impacted by what's going on with insulin, which will be impacted by what's going on with your estrogen, which will be impacted. Like, your body is so incredible and everything impacts everything else. So you can't ever just look at like one single thing in isolation and think it doesn't have an impact elsewhere. So it's really not that simple. And even things like short term, an increase in cortisol is a good thing. That's what wakes you up in the morning. Like, you want it. It's good. Much like when we talk about insulin, you want it. It's good. You just don't want chronically elevated levels of it. And the likelihood is, like, when you go, okay, so maybe those elevated levels would be bad if you knew that you actually had them because you are feeling stressed, right? What's way better than like trying to put a bucket under a leak there by taking a supplement that's going to lower your cortisol? No, get to the root cause of the problem, which is why are you so stressed? How do we help you with that? And then, hey, what's going to help with that? Oh, exercise, diet, taking some time for yourself, meditating, journaling. Like, it often all comes down to like the same things.
That we don't want to do.
Yeah. And then what's hard is that when you are stressed, you're normally really busy. And what's the first thing to go? diet, exercise, getting out for a walk, finding time to journal and meditate. And, it's this like stress cycle that becomes really hard.
Agreed. Okay. I both hope you're having a great week and both doing well. Fabulous week, Natalie. Fabulous. Okay, first question comes from more of a personal one in terms of nutrition and where it stands in terms of health for conditions. I have MS and have looked up information for trying to manage with nutrition. Looking at some quote-unquote diets, they say for autoimmune conditions seem very restrictive and, in my opinion, a bit much to completely cut out a lot of foods and food groups. In regards to foods having an inflammatory response like gluten or dairy, lean meat or eggs, and some root vegetables. Surely this is more down to your own personal inflammatory response, as in your body has a low tolerance rather than it being really bad for everyone, or is it these foods are like to create more inflammation in the body? It's causing me a little distress thinking I don't know what to eat for the best, and can totally see how people feel with diet information when trying to lose weight and don't know what to do for the best. So we've spoken about probably every autoimmune disease under the sun on the EIQ with a very similar question, and the answer is almost exclusively always the same, in that if you look up any meta-analysis, systematic review, any solid research around nutrition for autoimmune disease, it always says it's inconclusive. There's no evidence that's there to support any dietary style. The only one that sometimes emerges is the shockingly Mediterranean style anti-inflammatory. And I did actually look up to see if there were any new meta-analysis on chronic fatigue. And the most recent one, they suggested that in animal studies, supplementing with omega-3 and polyphenols potentially had something in them. But guess what those things are part of? An overall anti-inflammatory slash Mediterranean style diet. I hate how accounts and podcasts, etc., around autoimmune disease always focus on taking all of this stuff out of your diet, because there's no evidence to suggest that these things, like gluten, is not going to cause like this inflammatory response in your body that's going to worsen your symptoms. And having all of these restrictive mentalities around food, as we know, can be really unhelpful for your relationship with food. So with anyone I've worked with before in this situation, I will always encourage a Mediterranean style dietary pattern in some way, shape, or form. But I'll never recommend, okay, let's cut out dairy or let's cut out gluten or anything like that. And then a supplementation of omega-3 if you're not eating enough oily fish.
Yeah, the only, no, I need to go back and look this up. But the MS, I would say, is like slightly different than some chronic fatigue type diets, potentially, because it's like attacking the brain and the spinal cord. Now, again, I don't know enough about it. I just know I did a lot of research into Parkinson's disease, and there does seem to be like some quite interesting research on going keto. Now massively extreme, right? And again, full caveat, I've not looked into this for MS, and I don't know whether, because obviously the mechanism behind it is slightly different, whether that would be beneficial at all. So it would be worth like looking into it. But yeah, that's the only like I was like, huh, I wonder actually, because it might be slightly different given that it's so focused on brain and spinal cord.
Yeah, eventually. Okay, I have a client who has a good relationship with food and herself. However, with her training, wants her quote unquote legs to look less fat or wobbly. In my opinion, she doesn't need this, and her natural build is to carry a little more muscle, no, a little more in those areas, probably because she's a woman. I answered with, we can want to change how we look, that is okay. But it depends on the place it's coming from, if she thinks it's going to make her happy once she has this, or thinks that she will feel better. Is it okay to question back like that when someone asks about changing the way they look? When is it okay to want to change physical appearance for a more muscular look, for instance? Should we always question when someone wants to change this?
there's a way to question things. Like, it's fine for anybody to want to change. It's very different when you're changing because you absolutely hate the way that you look and you don't think you're going to be worthy until you change. And sometimes we come from that lens because of maybe our own experiences or because of clients we've had in the past. And sometimes you get someone who's just like, oh no, like I just want like really like lean and strong legs. I have no, like, I mean, I think I'm worthy without those. I just really want that. Like, I'm like, I want fucking sick triceps, right? I have no like issue with not having them. You know, I don't think, oh, I'm not going to be worthy until I have the best triceps in the world. I'm just like, I love having a goal. I love pushing myself. I love like how that feels. And if they can get behind that and you coach them well into that, and I would have that discussion because there probably is for most people an element of like, I didn't like myself until I get to this point. And if they can take that part away or like dampen that voice and be more like, okay, I'm enough now, but like I could be even better. Like I could, yeah.
I think it's really important that just because you know that, someone is not going to be happy when they achieve X or Y, that doesn't mean that it's not okay to seek those things. I think, yes, it's always okay to have the questions of like, oh, and like, is it that you want leaner, more muscular legs, or is it because you think all of your happiness is underneath that inch of body fat on your thighs? I'm happy to support you to get to that point, but on recognition that your happiness is probably not going to come from there. And that's fine. But it doesn't have to, like, it doesn't always have to be a deeper conversation, but just kind of opening it up to say what you've already said, I think is great. But yeah, I think we're quick to sometimes be like, oh, they think that they're going to be at this point when they get leaner. Okay, is it going to do them any harm to work on their body image at the same time as their relationship with food and also get leaner and find out for themselves that actually they're not happier when they're a bit leaner? As long as it's a healthful process and you're focusing on like those other things and you're not saying to someone, yeah, you're going to be happier when you're leaner. Like, everyone has autonomy and it's okay for people to go, oh, like, I thought I would be happy when I was competing. I probably thought I was happy when I was competing. And now I look back, I'm like, probably not so much. But at the time, I had to go through that. And so all you can do is guide people, I think.
Yeah, there's a really good quote on this, and now I can't remember it, but it's something like it's much easier to meet your goals and then decide that you don't want them than it is to never reach that goal. It's said in a way better way than that, because that's not the best quote. It's normally like in relation to money, right? Like the amount of millionaires that are like, oh guys, don't bother, it's so not worth it. And it's like, okay, and that's because you achieved it already. And I do sometimes see an air of that in the fitness industry of like, and we do that, right? I certainly do. I'm like, don't bother getting abs, it's not worth it. And it's like, yeah, because you got them and decided that. Or, and I know how hard it, but it's like, well, sometimes you have to push yourself a little bit to be like, oh God, it's not actually not worth it. And as long as that's not pushing yourself to the point of ruining your relationship with food and that taking years to rebuild, which it doesn't always have to be, especially if you've got a good coach who's like, yeah, I'll push you, but like it's fine to be like, that's enough, you know, like don't hold on to this pursuit of this goal just because you set it arbitrary one time and you didn't realize how hard it was going to be or what it was going to cost you in terms of other areas of your life. Same with business goals and stuff, you know, like you might decide the same, like actually, do you know what, I'm really happy sitting where I am and like I don't want to, you know, and like a similar thing might be, do you want a business that sits just below the VAT threshold and you live a really freaking great life? Or do you want to go way over it and run a like a much bigger business? Because sitting in between, it's not fun. Like that's not a great place to be. It's like either hit it and keep going or stay a bit under it. And like maybe there are other parts of your life that are the more important to you or that you enjoy more or that, yeah. And that's fine as well, but it's like it should be you and your goals and what you want your life to look like.
Agree. Okay, Annie's question. How would you go about supporting a client who felt like when they go into that shutdown free state, they feel so shut off or disconnected from their body that accessing some of those tools to upregulate or reconnect feels too difficult, as if doing anything about it in the moment feels quite out of reach?
About what? Sorry.
So they're in that free shutdown state, they feel so disconnected from their body that accessing some of those tools to upregulate or reconnect feels too difficult, as if doing anything about it in the moment feels quite out of reach. I'm trying to think what Kay might say. When what I say is not what Kay is saying, so don't attribute what I say to Kay because I could be way off and she'll be like, I would never say that. Part of me is inclined to say, allow it. Like, does this person have to immediately get out of that state? How is it impacting them? Is the pressure to get out of it actually unhelpful? So maybe I would pose to a person if I was working with them and they were in that situation. I would maybe pose and say, well, how would it feel to sit in that for an hour before you then thought, okay, I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to do some upright, like go to the gym or yoga or whatever it is, right? Or is there a tool that you can use that is more accessible? Like, for example, sticking your hands or your face in a ice water bath or whatever, because that can be quite upregulating for some people. Same as
I'm
jumping
not
in a
sure. I don't know if I understand the question. Like, what are you trying to upregulate into?
like nervous system, like they're in a downer, you know, like if they're in that hypo aroused state, so they're just like numb, apathetic, low. It can, and I guess like it can be a time where people will eat to try and find to get out of that. So if that's the thing, then that's obviously something that you might want to work on. But it's okay. I think normalizing, and Katie talked about this to be fair as well, normalizing that the goal is not to be all the way all time, like in the Zen state. The goal is to allow yourself to dip, to allow yourself to be hyper aroused and just be flexible and coming back down or coming back up. And so there is a part of me that's like, okay, well, that might be a normal state for them, and just give it a little bit of time, and then if they're still not, if they still feel, if they feel stuck, then it's like, okay, let's have this fierce compassion of like doing something easy, low bar of entry, even maybe doing something within their body like breath, like an upregulating breath work. It's not, doesn't require any access to anything. It's just like a prolonged inhale, shorter exhale. So I would question a little bit like the fierce compassion of that, whilst also again making space to the fact that things like mental health, like for example, if they're experienced depression, I'm not saying just think your way out of it or breathe your way out of it. Obviously, I'm talking about like those in the moment things.
Have they considered listening to the sound of or the Greatest Showman soundtrack?
That's it. Do you know that I might see that in concert?
No, but like if sorry, but if you can't get going off that, this is the greatest.
Classic.
That really useful coaching advice.
I really like that. There's also a couple of tracks on Tortured Poets Society, officially out recently, which are also excellent. So I highly recommend that. But yeah, movement to a greatest showman. Show, greatest showman. Yeah. There you go, Annie. You're welcome. That's the last question.
Oh, great. Fantastic. Okay, well, I hope everyone enjoyed that. We've got a very exciting announcement coming on EIQ very shortly. So
We
watch
do.
on the Instagram. And yeah, that's all. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.